This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, Wisconsin has a lot of bodies of water, and chances are you grew up near one or visited one sometimes or maybe moved closer to one. There's a pretty good chance that happened to you. Do you consider any of those water bodies to be meaningful to you? Do you have memories of going to the local lake to swim, or you spent a lot of time by the river walking to and from school, or maybe your memories center around fishing on frozen or thawed lakes? A Wisconsin artist has collected samples from bodies of water that are meaningful to her in Wisconsin and beyond to create her own water biography. Sarah Fitzsimons is an assistant professor of sculpture in the art department at UW-Madison. She's a visual artist who makes sculpture that interacts and takes meaning from its surroundings. A lot of her work is inspired by nature and her interest in earth sciences. Sarah's in the studio with me right now. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, you brought in an example here. Tell us what this water biography is.
Sure. So when I first took the job here back in 2011, a colleague had mentioned to me that we have something called a water library at this university. And now I had never heard of that before coming here. And it just sounded like such a mysterious, beautiful idea that it inspired me to decide to build my own. And I decided to start with my personal water biography. I went back and thought about every body of water I've grown up near or lived by and I've developed a connection to. And so the first installation of this is on view at the Chazen Museum of Art, a shelf of about 15 books of different bodies of water.
And you brought the Pacific Ocean with you today.
I did. I brought a piece of the Pacific Ocean with me today into the studio. When I used to live in Los Angeles. I went to school there and studied there. And when I was moving away, I filled up a bottle of water from the ocean and put it on the dashboard of my car as I was driving east to take another job. And I've had that bottle of water kicking around for a while. I do like seeing it in my studio in Wisconsin. It just reminded me of the memories I had living by the ocean, but also that my life here is connected to larger patterns in the world.
And it's this great, and this I think is true of a lot of your work, as I understand it. There's a science here. There's the earth science and the water science. There's the geography. There's that personal connection, and then there's the visual art. And you're tying all of these things together. What inspired you to work on all those levels?
Well, I really am interested in making art that can extend beyond the gallery or the museum. And in fact, with this show in the Chazen Museum, not only do I have a shelf of books in the museum itself, there are also books now embedded at the Kohler Art Library. The Atlantic Ocean is actually on reserve behind the front desk, available for viewing. And then the Wisconsin Water Library has a copy of Lake Michigan, and soon they will have a copy of Lake Superior. It's frozen over now, so I've been having a hard time getting the water.
Now, we should describe what this looks like when we say a water book. I got to look at it and hold it a few minutes ago. Describe it for our listeners.
So they're book-sized, and you can hold them in your hands and open them, sort of one page. There's a differentiation. The cover is a translucent material, and inside is a clear material. So you can see the water, and you can also see your hands through the water as you're holding the book. And I collected samples. I didn't do anything to the samples, so you have bits of sand. Sometimes things are starting to grow in them. But each book is a slightly different size depending on the size of the body of water. And the only text on the book is on the spine, you have etched the name of the body of water.
Talking to Sarah Fitzsimons, professor at UW-Madison and artist, talking about her water biography, samples of water in these plastic books from around the world. What does a body of water have to do to enter into your biography? What is it that makes you feel that connection with a particular body of water?
That's a good question. I think, well, first of all, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, so Lake Erie was a few minutes down the street. And for me, I think about different places I've lived, and I have memories connected with spending time, maybe swimming in that body of water. But for me, it needed to be a body of water that evoked some type of emotional connection to a period in my life. So I have rivers in there. There's a hot spring, a couple oceans, some lakes, etc.
I also love, this is something that's harder to take to a show, but you've done shoreline art with a bed on the shores of a body of water or this sort of bar structure. Mm. What's it like to do sculpture? And you've got a big one in a forest somewhere that's not a water-themed one. Can you talk about doing
Sure.
those on-site installations, I guess?
That's a great question. I think also this idea of getting out of the gallery is exciting to me because if you're doing a show indoors, you can plan everything out. You pretty much know how it's going to go. But once you're outside, you have the weather to deal with. You have the power of tides or running water. And so it adds in this element of unpredictability. And I find that really exciting. Sometimes things get destroyed I hadn't expected or other interesting things happen. But that's just one of the benefits of working outdoors.
You've worked in a scientific setting in some ways. I've seen videos of you working with these wave generators where people try to study waves, just I guess to predict what they're going to do next. How has that inspired you in your art?
Sure. Yeah. When I was a graduate student out at UCLA, we had one of these large wave tanks where scientists are using them to simulate different shoreline conditions and study waves. And they give you a really beautiful view of a wave, especially if the sides are glass. You get a view of a wave sort of bisected by this glass container. And that's just not a view you can ever get in nature. So, from the very beginning, I've always been interested in that art science back and forth. And I've taken a number of science classes in addition to studying art.
And just our last few moments for the rest of us, would you encourage us to set up our own water biographies?
Well, I'd be really curious to hear if other people have had that experience of taking water with them from one location to another. When I went to the post office in Los Angeles to mail some Pacific Ocean water back to Wisconsin, they said, wow, this isn't the first time we've seen it. Doesn't happen very often, but it's happened before.
So. Interesting. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sarah Fitzsimons, Assistant Professor of Sculpture in the Art Department at UW-Madison. She joined us for a look at her water library and other works inspired by bodies of water. She has some work on display in the faculty exhibition at the Chazen Museum in Madison through May 10th. She's giving a talk there at the Chazen about the collection on Tuesday, April 21st at 5:30 p.m. Coming up, light pollution is usually thought of as a big city problem, but our guest says development outside of cities is having a bigger impact than you might think. We'll find out why the night sky is less visible just about everywhere we go. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For anyone who loves a dark, starry night sky, staying away from big cities is maybe a given. And while light pollution is the worst in urban areas, our next guest discovered something surprising when he mapped our light sources in the United States while adjusting for population. He found that many rural areas are actually getting a larger share of light pollution per person, something he ties to a busy decade of development outside of urban centers. Tim Wallace is a cartographer at Descartes Labs. He also got his PhD from UW-Madison. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
When people think of light pollution, they might think of the big cities. You took a kind of a different look. How did you put this map together with our light sort of per capita?
Sure. Yeah. So I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I do a lot of driving to remote areas. And sometimes I see more light than I would expect. And so I had this idea that I could take two different data sets, one that was a population data set, and one that is luminance at night, a nighttime lights data set, and sort of subtract the population from the light. And the result showed off a lot of sort of surprising patterns.
Yeah, hit us with some of those surprises you found when you put those two things together.
Well, so one of them is, I think that they're referred to as fulfillment centers. They're sort of these, they're in exurbs or sometimes in rural areas. Outside of cities, and there are places where, there's an Amazon fulfillment center, or there's some kind of shipping hub, and there's these giant buildings. If you look at them in satellite imagery, some of them are like as big as a mile long. And of course, you know, people don't live there, so they don't show up in the population data set, but they do kick off a lot of light, so they'll show up. They'll show up at night. Some of the other ones were like, there's one spot in Maine where you can see a tomato greenhouse complex, which is like was really surprising to me. I have family in Maine, and I did not know there was a massive tomato greenhouse complex there.
And there was a huge bright spot looking at your map in North Dakota. What's going on there?
Oh, so that is oil and gas activity. When you frack, you often have to burn off the gas that is leaking out of the ground. And so some of it, I imagine, is actual the flaring of, you know, burning methane. And some of it is probably, you know, from the infrastructure related to oil and gas.
And we don't have those huge fracking projects here in Wisconsin. Did you happen to notice anything that stood out for you in our neck of the woods?
Well, so Fort McCoy, the fort.
Sure.
popped out because I suspect there is no official census information about military locations. Also malls and again those fulfillment centers. There was one spot in particular that was where there was I got distracted by candy because there's like a Jelly Belly, either factory or like tour place.
Yeah.
Outside of, I think, Kenosha. And that whole area just really popped because there's a lot of activity there. There's a lot of industry, but there aren't any people living there.
Now, working as a cartographer, people, I don't think maybe necessarily think of the sort of creativity that might go into something like this. How do you try to come up with the ideas like this, putting together two different things to see what stands out when we look at things from a different point of view?
Sure. So I spent years at the New York Times on the graphics desk making maps, and most of the maps that I made there were very purposeful around politics or global conflict or some kind of disaster. But I went to the University of Wisconsin and came through the cartography lab there where you're encouraged to experiment. And so I've always had kind of playful ideas in my head floating around, and this idea of normalizing something, adjusting something by population is not uncommon in cartography. It's what you do with a lot of maps. It's what we do with political maps, with election results maps. They show the margin of victory. They don't show the total number of people who voted because it's easier to read. And with something like a nighttime lights image, it's not maybe intuitive to normalize it by people, but because a nighttime lights image at first glance looks almost identical to a population map, I thought it would be a good thing to look at to see what those little differences were.
Speaking of the New York Times, you recently worked on a project that mapped the development in ex-urban areas, so not the big cities, not the denser suburbs, over the last 10 years. And this definitely feeds into this light story, too. And you did these before and after satellite views of a lot of these areas. What struck you about the kind of changes and the pace of change we see?
Well, so much struck me about what has changed. But again, back to those fulfillment centers, that was one that really popped. That they really, I think, as the internet has matured and e-commerce has gotten stronger and stronger, this type of infrastructure has just really blown up. So a lot of our sort of national map of change over the last 10 years, a lot of it were those types of developments. But also, as you mentioned, the exurbs, it's not necessarily change we're seeing in a city where maybe the city is growing, but it might be growing up, so we wouldn't be able to see it with satellite imagery quite as well. It's sort of the sprawl around cities, especially in the Midwest and in the West, where there's a little bit more area to spread out.
And you did these before and after that are, maybe 5 or 10 years apart, and it made me think of, living in a place where you see, oh, that got built, or if it's a big thing, you see the construction project, so it seems gradual, versus maybe going back to your hometown after 20 years and everything's changed. There's this huge story of a changing landscape here that we're kind of too close to see without taking this step back.
It's true. You don't necessarily notice these things when you watch them happen slowly over the course of a decade. But like, honestly, if I came back to Madison right now, because it's been quite a few years, I probably would notice those changes the same way I would in this, satellite analysis. It's a fun thing to take to, the beginning and an end that are that far apart and look at, substantial change.
Tim, any other project you're curious to try to map in the future?
Oh, I'm constantly mapping stuff I'm curious about. I work at Descartes Labs now in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're a geospatial analytics company, and I have the distinct pleasure of being the creative lead here. And what that means is I get to experiment. And so along with my colleague, Krishna Kara, I am literally every week doing something I'm pretty sure no one has ever done before. So we're mapping things that that we couldn't before because the technology didn't exist. We couldn't crunch that much data, or we weren't able to get all those data sets together in one place. And it's fun. And so I try to share it as much as possible.
Tim, thanks so much for sharing it with us today.
Thank you.
Tim Wallace is a cartographer at Descartes Labs in New Mexico and a PhD graduate from UW-Madison. He talked to us about his map showing that light pollution is a growing issue in rural areas. You can see that map at WPR.org/Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Voting is a civil right that people can lose when they're convicted of a felony. But Wisconsin's a state where that right is restored eventually once someone's released from prison and completed their full sentence, including things like extended supervision. But some members of that population may not be familiar with what happens with their rights. The Wisconsin group Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, or EXPO, is working to educate people in that situation and to change the laws to restore those voting rights sooner. Sarah Ferber is Associate Director of EXPO Statewide. She joins us from our studio in Eau Claire. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into this voter information initiative, can you give us a wider look at some of what EXPO does?
Absolutely. So EXPO was established in 2014, and we're part of the Wisdom Network, which is a faith-based network. And EXPO is leadership development and advocacy. So we really focus on upstream policy change versus, you know, downstream service providers.
So what does that mean? Who is it that you're working with to promote to leadership roles?
So I would say, you know, different leaders come to our meetings. And then as the organizer, I try to identify certain skills. And that's how, you know, somebody might go to a training, for example. And then the training that we give, the major one, is the Gamaliel National Leadership Training. And that's a national training. I'm actually on the trainer track. And it's a full immersion for a full week, and people come out changed.
And this
ready
is
to go, ready to roll.
This is mainly for people who have been incarcerated themselves. Is that right?
No, actually, Gamaliel offers this. So again, being a faith-based organization, they've been around for quite a few years as Wisdom has. So they've been providing this training for quite some time. Now, when EXPO started going to the training, we noticed things that could be a little bit better, we could change, and they've actually been quite accommodating for those things. So once in a while, we'll have an EXPO-specific week-long, but there's 3 national week-longs each year.
Now let's get into this push by EXPO to help register ex-felons to vote in Wisconsin. Where did this idea, this initiative come from?
Yeah, so as we're out talking in the community or get members that come to our meetings, we're noticing more and more that people who have a felony conviction believe that they can never vote again. So that's sort of where it started. And so we were reaching out, letting people know that they could vote. You know, we've been doing that for a couple of years. And when our local legislator, Jody Emerson, was elected, she got right on it and went and wrote some legislation along with Lena Taylor and David Crowley out of Milwaukee. And that is there's 2 parts of that Unlock the Vote bill. The first part is to restore voting rights as soon as a person leaves an institution. So if you're out in the community working, paying taxes, you should be able to choose, have a voice in who is your representative. And then the other piece of the bill is that is prison gerrymandering. So I've been hearing a lot about fair maps the last couple of years. So what a lot of people don't know is that when a person's in prison, they are counted in that community. So I'll give you an example. Stanley Prison is in the, you know, out in the country. It's very rural and very homogenous, I would say, with white people for the most part. And then you have the prison there. And so if you look at a map of Wisconsin, you can see little dots of people of color. And those dots usually represent prisons. So now Stanley is going to receive the census. So we do the census, and then that determines how many dollars each community gets. Stanley will receive dollars for all of those inmates for the next 10 years. So we're trying to change that and have people counted back where they're from. So say if a person gets arrested in Milwaukee, that's where they should be counted.
Under current law, when does that person who's been in prison for a felony, when do they currently get their right to vote back?
So they say when the sentence is complete, which sentences include probation and extended supervision. So that's the current law. And again, we feel that, you know, this is a democracy, and people who are out working, living in the community, something like voting shouldn't be a punishment. You know, taking your voting rights away shouldn't be a means of punishment. It should be a citizenship right that nobody loses.
I know there are a lot of things involved with bringing somebody out of prison and integrating them back into the community. How important is it for that person out of prison to participate in something, a basic civic part of democracy like voting.
Yeah, I would say it even goes beyond people who have been in prison. So I myself have not been in prison, but I spent certain periods of time in jail. And I had never been civically engaged my entire life. And getting involved in this work opened that whole world up to me, that even though I couldn't vote, I could go and speak at the county board meeting, for example. And there was other ways that I could still have my voice heard and get the issues that I cared about, you know, in front of the legislators. So, yeah.
Talking to Sarah Ferber, Associate Director of EXPO, that's Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing Statewide, looking at an effort to get former felons who have their voting rights back to let them know that they have those rights and to get them out and voting. Sarah, how are you reaching out to find former felons who may not be aware that they can vote again?
Yes, we've done something a little bit different than most canvases do. So if you think about a political canvas, they look at where the highest voter turnout is. So they'll go to just those neighborhoods. They really are focused on that. We're doing the opposite. So if there's a neighborhood that has almost a no propensity voter turnout, we'll go there. Because the chances are it's probably a poverty community neighborhood, and then they probably are highly policed. Therefore, they probably have some people with felonies that are living there. So that canvas has helped a lot as well.
What are some reasons you hear from people who had been incarcerated about why they haven't pursued voting again?
They think they can't. I mean, that was the number one reason is like they would be like, no, I can't vote. I'm a felon. And then we would have to get in the whole discussion of, well, that's not actually true. If you're done with probation or parole or extended supervision, you are able to vote. And so just really educating them on what the actual law is really important.
Is it confusing in part because in some states they'd be right? In some states, felons never get their voting rights back, though Wisconsin isn't one of those states?
Yes, you're exactly correct. So down in Florida, where we spent some time about a year ago helping out with their voting rights campaign, they were able to restore voting rights to 800,000 people. And that was a place that you lost your voting rights forever. And they were able to change the legislation, and then they had some issues. They tried to put that you had to pay all of your fines first before you could do it. Then they filed against that and found that to be a debtor's prison type situation. So, you know, they were able to do it down in Florida, which is a conservative state, and they had an overwhelming yes down there. Unfortunately, we don't have ballots like that where we put issues on the ballot. So what we're trying to do is just really educate people and have them paying attention to who is for that, and then also calling their representatives, asking their representatives to please sign on to the bill.
And I imagine for some people, depending on the timing, if they went to prison, say, at age 18, they might never have voted at the
yes.
time they come out of prison. It might be an entirely new experience for them. Is that something you encounter?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I do have one colleague that is out of Racine, and although he did vote once when he was 18, he was incarcerated at a young age before the next election came. And so he will be on parole, or extended supervision, rather, until 2033. So even though he is active in the community in various different ways, he runs the community table type place down there, but he still can't have a say in who his alderman is or who his county board supervisors are. And we really think that that's wrong because we give people a lot of probation.
If there are people out there listening, they know they have a felony conviction in the past. They're not sure whether they can vote yet or not, or they want to get involved with EXPO. How can they get in touch, get their questions answered, or even get involved?
Yeah, so we have EXPO meetings here in Eau Claire every second Monday of the month at First Presbyterian Church. And then the different chapters across the state have different times. They could go to our website, expowisconsin.org, and it does list the times of all of the various chapter meetings that are across the state.
For people listening who haven't had this experience themselves, they've never been incarcerated, maybe they don't have a family member who has been, can you make the case that it's important to bring ex-felons back into the process and get them voting?
Yes, absolutely. There's studies out there that show that civic engagement actually reduces recidivism. When people feel connected to their community, they're less likely to commit crimes in that community. So when we talk about public safety, actually allowing people with convictions to vote would actually decrease recidivism and increase public safety.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Sarah Ferber, Associate Director of Expo Statewide. We talked to her today about her organization of ex-incarcerated people's initiative to find other released felons and remind them about their voting rights.